The Book of Ruth. Now, historically, they're attempting to put this in some kind of historical, you know, chronology. And the Book of Ruth, and you'll see this. It happens somewhere in the middle. This narrative takes place somewhere in the middle of the age of the judges. So, if you were to put a date on that, 1200 BC. Okay, King David would be 1,000 years before Christ. This would be just a couple years backwards from that. So right around 1,300 years before the Lord Jesus arrived. That's the time frame. It's a very Jewish passage, of course, and it's got a lot of Jewishness in it. You would expect that from an Old Testament book, but I mean a lot of cultural things that are completely foreign to us. For example, it kind of focuses on two things, the Levirate marriage, which I'll talk about in just a moment, and this idea of a kinsman redeemer. This book really does focus predominantly on redemption, and we're going to learn about redemption in the weeks to follow. How does God buy something back that was used, exploited, even devalued? How does God reach into this world and take something rusty and out of date and useless and buy it back and bring value to it again? That's what the Book of Ruth is all about, okay? You also should know this is a very Messiah-heavy book. Without the Book of Ruth, there would be a massive, you know, blank, a massive missing piece in the genealogy of Christ. This is the very book that allows us to follow from King David to Jesus and have a ongoing and proper family tree or genealogy, as we would call it, okay? This ties King David to, you know, ultimately Christ, through this beautiful Bethlehem, Judah bloodline. So it's a pretty important book as it relates to the Messiah. That's enough intro. I get bored with intro. Let's get in. Chapter 1, verse 1 goes like this. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He and his wife and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the name of his two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. All right, this background is very fast. It just gives us a very fast overview. There's very little details, but allow me just to slow down a little bit and kind of fill in some of the blanks. Some of this is speculation, but some of it is certain. First of all, guys, if you see in God's economy the term famine or drought or, foreign enemies invading, there's something that we should always conclude, especially during this dispensation, right? If there's famine, if people are going hungry in the land that flows with milk and honey, you know, I got a polar tip up in my mind, but a red flag, right? Something ought to spring and tell us something's off here. This is a problem in God's economy. The people of God clearly were out of step. The people of God were clearly not obeying him in this particular season that we're reading about. God does that, you know. He works in cues in our life to show us things are off. We need to run back to him. We need to make things right. We need to make some adjustments. We have, by our manufacturer, he's called the Most High, Yahweh, God. We have idiot lights worked in for free. Isn't that awesome? I got idiot lights. My dash sometimes is lit up like a Christmas tree, man, just going off all over the place. And I'm foolish, aren't I, if I ignore those and run, ignore the problem, bury the problem. My loving Creator designed you and me both, for example, with the capacity to feel guilt. I'd like you to think about that for a second, and I'd like you to repeat that in your heart and your mind as I do. Our loving and merciful Creator designed you and me with a capacity to feel guilt. And for some reason, in 2022, we've decided that's a bad thing. And we've designed very highly credentialed and very polished ways of shutting guilt off. We can medicate ourselves out of guilt. Did you know that? We can shut guilt off with medicine. We've learned to do it. We can distract ourselves from guilt with the pursuit of pleasure and ease and, you know, don't look over here. You know, we can distract ourselves with all kinds of deep impression. It's true. And all of that is not creating a better society. It's definitely not creating a better you. And I don't mean to be cliche in saying that. I don't even mean it that way. But I'm telling you, if your guilt alarm is going off, it's because there's sin in your life. And what we should do is go to the sin doctor, Jesus himself, and allow him to remedy the problem, right? We need an oil change. We just sang about it. We need an oil change. It's filled with filings and a milky substance, and, you know, we're going to blow our motor quick if we don't allow the Lord to change us and transform us and wash us clean. So sadly, this is a story where a man, and it seems at least one point in his life, a man of means, by the way, he's looking around his community and he doesn't know how to feed his wife and kids, and he does what most of you and I have done. He doesn't deal with the problem. He doesn't go to the manufacturer. He just tucks tail and runs. He's a hippie. This is the first Jewish hippie in the Bible. That's the truth. And he has this weird motto, and that's this, guys. With every problem, there's a geographical solution. That's what this hippie concludes. That's the truth. And he just decides to run out of the area, run out of his home, and not deal, but go find better times and better scenarios and better circumstances away from God. Okay, first of all, you know, Christianity 101, you will never find better times, better scenario, better circumstances, better anything away from God. The end. I should put that in book form. I'd make all kinds of money. Maybe not. But think about that, guys. Their solution is to run away from the covenant people, run away from the covenant land, run away from God, accountability, coming to the temple and offering sacrifices for their sin. Everything about this plan, sorry, Elimelech, is a bad plan. Everything about it. And there's no blessing here. In fact, the problem goes from bad to worse, if you know the story, don't you? And so they come into the country of Moab, and the country of Moab is, well, there's some history there, isn't there? You know, Moab was one of the very fleshly, impulsive sons of Lot. And if you know that story, Lot's very desperate daughters, with everybody in their community now dead, wondering, how will we ever be mommies? They take matters into their own hands. And if you know that story, Amnon and Moab, they are the result of horrible, heinous, incestuous, drunken sin. And unfortunately, they become long-standing enemies and a thorn in Israel's side. This is where this Jewish family runs, to the people of Moab. False gods, idolatry, debauched culture. This is where they run for a haven, for safety. Bad plan once again. Very quickly, just to make this a little bit modern and relative, you know, can we just look at our own situation? Maine. I think Maine is lacking the blessing of God, personally. As I look at my economy and as I look at my country, as I look at things, there's a lack of God's hand of blessing. There's a lack of God's, you know, providence in many ways, and things for many, many people are getting harder and harder and harder. You know what I see in America? People just leaving their state, leaving problems, and let's all go to Florida. You know, and it sounds good, right? Florida meaning the freedom that's there, and the government that there is really a great thing, actually. But I see people just emptying out and leaving the state that we were raised in. And I personally believe to deal with the problem might be a better solution than running from the problem. To stand for what's right, and you know, even if we are the last ones here, that's a personal conviction. Please don't hear that wrong. If you move from Maine, you're not in sin. That's weird. I'm just saying this mass exodus I see all over the country, people leaving the states that are under the thumb and lacking blessing, running to places that are, maybe a better solution is all I'm saying is go to our Creator and go to the manufacturer and say, all right, why is all this happening? What can we do? What about repentance? What about, you know, starting fresh with our Lord and allow him to cleanse us and wash us? And I just think personally, that might be a better solution. But here we see a family on the run. We have their names. Their names are absolutely significant. Elimelech's name implies that God is king. God is king. But his actions certainly don't suggest that. Naomi, which we become very familiar with, her name implies, you know, pleasant, right? What a beautiful name. Pleasant in every way. Maybe was brought up in a little Jewish family where times were good, and God blessed them with this beautiful little girl, man, and mom and dad named her Pleasant. But times are tough, and that's going to fleet away quickly. And both of their sons are basically named names that imply a sickness. We don't know the story. Again, this is kind of a subjection. I'm speculating here, but, you know, for these two names that mean, you know, basically sickly and weak and puny, that's what these names, maybe these were preemie childs. Maybe they were born because of the famine and mom wasn't getting a good diet, so of course breastfeeding was compromised. Maybe they just were unhealthy babies. That's very likely. But like so many, they are leaving their area because they've gotten word, man, there's food over there. I'm not going to watch my family starve, and they're just running for the border. Let's continue. Verse 3 says that Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. We don't have the details. Don't have the details, but he died. And she was left. So now she's a widow with two sons. And those sons took them wives of the women of Moab. And the name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. And they dwelled there about 10 years. So you have a decade that Naomi and these two boys, who married hometown girls, foreign girls, by the way, pagan girls, by the way, the consequence of running to the world and away from God. And 10 years go by. 10 years. Some happy times, potentially. Seems that she at least had some temporary bread. But I can't wait for you to see how this thing goes full circle. After that 10 years expires, it tells us in verse 5 that Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Premature death, we do know that for sure, because there's no children in either of these relationships. You got these two men who married foreign wives, and it doesn't seem like any children were part of the picture, okay? That's where that Levirate marriage comes in, or Levirate marriage. I've heard it pronounced both ways, so take your pick, I suppose. What is that? It's odd from our perspective, but here's how it works, okay? And it's very important to understand in light of the Book of Ruth, okay? In the Jewish culture, according to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 25, Leviticus mentions this. If I am a man that takes a wife and I die prematurely and I don't leave to this woman any offspring, any seed, as it's worded in the Old English, in the Old Testament, then actually the duty to marry that woman and raise up seed unto me, the dead man, actually, falls on my younger brother, the next brother in line. And again, that seems really odd to us because we live in a very different culture, but that's the way it would work. If I married a woman, and they married much younger back then, by the way, if I'm a 16, 17-year-old young man and I'm married and I have a tragic accident at work, for example, and I don't make it home one afternoon, and this new bride of mine never did get pregnant, never did have a child, then my younger brother, even if he's 10, he'd have to wait 4 or 5 years, 6 years. And then he would marry the lady that I left barren. And the first child they have, at least, would actually be considered the dead guy's child. So I could have a son in that culture, even though I haven't been on the earth for 10 years. Again, odd. But if you understand the preservation of the seed, if you understand that God made a promise way back in Genesis, right? The seed of the woman is going to rise up and crush your head. You understand it has everything to do with this male offspring that ultimately points to the Messiah and protecting and preserving that bloodline, the most important bloodline. You know, in this context, of course, I'm referring to the line of Judah, the line of David, and specifically through, you know, Solomon, the king, but Nathan is the bloodline. You know, I'm talking about Matthew and Luke's genealogies. So there you have that. So both of these daughters have been left without children, and they have the only connection in this family at this point is Naomi, their mother-in-law. Okay, it's getting good. It's getting interesting. Verse 6, let's start right there again, just for to reiterate. She arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab how the Lord had visited his people in giving them bread. I'm curious as how that news was received by Naomi. As she's there, at that point she's a widow, seems premature, by the way. It's only 10 years have gone by, and her husband was 10 years young enough to make a long foreign journey. So in 10 years, he's gone. They didn't expect that, I promise. And now both of her young, strapping sons are gone. And then in that horrible place, which you know what she's thinking, right, ladies, right, moms? God, you're against me. I should never have left my country. What was I thinking? We were just hungry. We didn't know what to do. And she's just going through her mind all the woulda, coulda, shouldas, just like we do. Just like we do as people, the regrets and the horrible place she's at mentally. And then she gets the news. She flips on the news one morning and she sees, man, in Israel, their times are good again. Probably one of these judges that we just studied was currently ruling and God's favor was there again. The enemies had been driven back and there was a time, at least a temporary time of prosperity. And she hears about it. And you know, at that point, she feels pretty grimy. Man, I betrayed my people. They went through this and survived it, and they're back enjoying good times. If I just would have stuck it out, I would have had my husband, presumably. I would have had my sons. I could have even had godly daughters-in-law, maybe some grandkids at this point. And isn't regret a tool, guys, that the enemy beats us with? Doesn't regret become something so bitter in our lives? So very bitter. Takes us from pleasant to bitter really fast. And you'll see Naomi, attest to that very thing. But she has made a decision at this point. She's like, I'm going back. I'm going back to where I belong. I should never have left. I'm going back to, check this out, the house of years ago. But now, once again, it's full of bread. That's the deal. And so she is determined at this point to pack her suitcase and say her goodbyes to her pagan foreign daughters at this point. Go back in humility. Go back in brokenness. So here we go. Let's read about that. It tells us in verse 8, and Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, go, return each to her mother's house, and the Lord deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead and with me. So she dismisses them. You go back home. I got nothing for you, girls. Thank you so much for being my son's wives. I mean, we had some happy times. Thank you so much for being such good daughter-in-laws to me. You guys have been so kind to me, even though it's so clear at this point, God's against me. I got nothing to offer you. You don't owe me anything. Get out of here. Go back to where you have food, where you have family, where you could be something. Go back and marry some of your own men. They can give you children. That's all implied in this. I'm releasing you from this. You don't owe me a thing. Okay? Well, how they respond to that is in verse 9. She goes on to say this, the Lord grant you that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. And then she kissed them and they lifted up their voice and wept. Just this sad departure. All three of these ladies, man, they had been through a lot together, actually, at this point. They, all three of them, lifted up their voice and wept. You know what's really precious about this little threesome, this little group of ladies? They have something that has bound them together, and it's actually what the New Testament refers to as the fellowship of suffering. That's the one thing these three girls have in common. They have been through horrible heartache together, horrible loss. And, you know, when we're in the midst of that, let's be honest, when we're in the midst of horrible loss, it's like, how can anything good come out of this? This is why, God, and we go through that. But look, and I just would ask you to just glance around the room. This is a Jewish woman and two Moabite women. They have probably no chance of ever interacting and definitely not having this common bond like this where they're weeping and they very much love each other at this point. But it has everything to do with the trials and the heartache of life. It has bound these women together in a really profound way. And I would suggest that is Machias Christian Fellowship in such a real way. We as a church have been through a lot together in 15 years. We've experienced a ton of loss. We've experienced tragic loss, untimely death. We've gone through trials together, health trials. We've seen God do tremendous things in the midst of it all. And in the middle of those horrible phone calls and the horrible news and the untimely loss, nothing made sense when it was unrolling in real time, right? Why? God, I don't get it. I don't understand. But what has it done? It has given us a very precious fellowship, hasn't it? And we've rallied around the sufferings of this life, and God has allowed us to look above it to his glorious Son, where there is victory and redemption and an honest future and a hope. Look what God has done, guys. He's taken a bunch of ragtag, broken people with all kinds of baggage and wreckage, and he's just glued us together. Try to separate this. Try to. We say to the world around us, you go ahead and try to separate this family, you're going to get bit, right? Because we've been through so much together at this point. Bit's rated G too, isn't it? You're going to get shot. But think about that, guys. Truly, think about what God has done in here. Can we just stop for a minute and stop putting God on the judgment seat and realize, man, he had a plan in all this. He allows suffering. He has a greater purpose in it all. And man, I see Naomi, I see Ruth, and even Orpah. Orpah is the tragic weak link in this. You know the story. But man, some pretty awesome stuff is going on in this little picture here that we have to see and see rightly. Okay, there's a good cry, and there's such a thing as that, isn't there? There's such a thing as a good cry. There's also such a thing as a bad cry. There's also such a thing as a knock it off cry. This is a good cry. This is very appropriate. Verse 10, and they said unto her, surely we will return with thee unto thy people. No, we're going with you. And I know some commentaries suggest that only one of them meant it. I'm not so sure. I think at that point, I think they both meant it. But then one of them starts to think about what that actually entails and what that actually means. But I think at this point, there was sincere emotion. Verse 11, and Naomi said, turn again, my daughters. Why? Why will you go with me? And there yet any more sons, or are there yet any more sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Again, that is a very Jewish thing. Very Jewish thing. Sorry, girls, I am way beyond the years of producing children. She's an older lady at this point, you know. Hot flashes, come and gone. She's now just cold all the time. Just cold. Always cold. Turn the heat up. You understand? Is that okay to say? Womb is not no longer fertile. That probably would have been better. If I would have written notes, I would have said it that way the first time. But she's saying, listen, there's no more. You guys would be waiting forever. I have nothing more to offer you. You should definitely go and make, you're beautiful. You are beautiful young ladies. You're so talented. Don't follow me. Following me would certainly lead you to just misery and an empty life. She's actually kind of pleading with them to reconsider. I think because she does have their best interest in heart. I really do. Turn again, my daughters. Go your way. I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I should have a husband also tonight and should also bear sons, would you tarry for them till they were grown? Would you stay for them for having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. So she's taking full responsibility for all this. Your plight is my fault, and I'm not going to put you through it anymore. Now, there's a lot of guilt at this point in Naomi's heart, a lot of guilt. But she's saying, even if I was get married today and miraculously I had kids, are you going to wait around 16, 18, 20 years before they're eligible? I wouldn't expect that from you. Yeah, that's the idea. The whole thing grieves me. Get away from me because I'm just a curse. It's really sad where this lady's at, truthfully. They lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpah, and this is interesting, kissed her mother-in-law. But Ruth clave unto her. You see the difference? Orpah kissed her. Ruth clave. And that's the difference, guys. And that, and I'm sorry to say so, that right there divides this room in two different groups. Right down the middle. There are those that would in an act of worship, in an act of emotional peak, you know, kiss the Lord, so to speak, you know, just have a momentary experience, but then we go back and return to our false gods and false practices and sin ultimately. That's Orpah. She has this emotional peak and she expresses her love, but that's Sunday. Monday morning, she goes right back to her false Moabite gods and goddesses. But Ruth is a young lady who cleaves. And not just to Naomi. We're going to see Ruth is cleaving to much more than Naomi. We'll see that in just a moment. But Ruth would be a very, very good Old Testament example of what it means to abide in Christ. That's what we're called to, guys. The second half of this room, we got the kissers and the cleavers, okay? The kissers, they love that emotional experience with God. They love maybe a good worship service where they felt something. Maybe they felt the presence of God. Or maybe in a desperate emotional scene, they reach out for God and he's merciful enough to bail them out or to demonstrate his love and mercy. But man, that doesn't play out. That type of person that's impulsive and lives in the circumstance, that doesn't play out to successful, victorious Christian living at all. But it's those that abide in Christ. Emotions come and go, but we cleave to what we know based on faith, based on what it is written. There's the difference, okay? And you're going to go through seasons, you cleavers in the room. You go through seasons of famine, spiritually speaking. You go through seasons of drought where you just don't sense anything. You'll read the Bible and you wonder if your mic is turned off or muted. But you refuse to let go of your Lord because it is written. That's Christianity. That's Christianity. And men, it doesn't work if we just ride the waves of emotion and ride the waves of fun. Don't be an Orpah, be a Ruth. And there's a valuable lesson in that, that's for sure. Valuable lesson. We see a lot of Orpahs. We've also had the privilege to know a lot of Ruths too. But look at verse 5, and she said, behold. I love this too, because Ruth gets a little feisty. If we could read this in the original language and in the emotion, we could really hear it. There's a little bit of a feistiness that happens. It's almost, and you study this out, read the active participles and the action words that are in this. She's almost like, you listen to me. You listen to me, Naomi. She gets a little jealous. Okay? Behold, excuse me, this is Naomi. Behold, thy sister-in-law has gone back unto her people and unto her gods. Isn't that sad? That quickly. Big cry. Oh, I love you. Kissed her. Right back to her gods. Return thou after your sister-in-law. And Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee. Okay, that is so dull in the English. But she's saying, do not say that to me one more time. That's what she's saying. Don't invite me to leave you ever again. That's the idea. Whoa. And you know Naomi's like, you know, she's looking through swollen, tearful eyes, and then all of a sudden Ruth says, you listen to me. Don't ever say that again. Whoa, what got into you? And then this speech, which is inspirational to me. Don't ever invite me to leave or return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go. Wherever you go, I'm following you. And where you live, I'm going to live. Your people shall be my people, and most importantly, church, and thy God, my God. That's what she was cleaving to ultimately. She saw, and it's sad because Naomi didn't think it was there. Okay? I don't know who you are tonight. You feel like, well, man, I am so off. I'm so discouraged and depressed. Does anybody see any faith in me? What kind of example am I? I have precious people in my life that visit this place often. You know what? How am I inspirational? But you know what? Ruth actually saw something in Naomi. She said, I can't imagine my life in any other place. Your God has been so inspirational through you to me. I will only worship him. Isn't that cool? She saw something in Naomi that Naomi couldn't see in herself. Because faith is like that, right? Faith is like that. A belief in God is like that. Be encouraged if you think, man, I've blown it. I've been a discouragement to the cause. Nah. If your faith is authentic, actually, it's a lot louder and brighter than you might realize, truthfully. But, you know, Ruth wasn't having it. And then this is what I love. You know, God is a kind of a generic word, isn't it? And you would expect maybe from a pagan, a foreigner, to have a generic understanding of God. She uses the term Elohim, a generic word. But this is what I really love. Where you die, I'll die. And there will I be buried. And look at this, L-O-R-D, all capital. It's the name of God, guys. Literally, that Moabitess woman speaks the name Yahweh. Now, that tells me there's actually more of an understanding and more of a personal acquaintance with God than just the generic, you know, theos or Elohim. She says, Yahweh, do so to me. And more also, if aught but death part thee and me, you know. This is what I love about Ruth. She is willing to go with Naomi and be a part of her life and be, most importantly, a worshiper of her God, even though she agrees with Naomi, there's probably nothing in this world in it for me. Now, let that one settle in. You're probably right. I'll probably never be a mommy. I'll probably never be a wife again. We'll probably just, you and me, an old widow and a foreign woman in a land like Israel, we will probably scratch out a living and shake a coffee can the rest of our lives. But you know what? I'd rather die with you in worship of your God than hoop it up out here with my beautiful foreign eyes and my beautiful foreign hair. Do you understand? She was literally willing to accept nothing in this earth but God. Wow. That is what we would call reckless abandon, right? That's somebody who would say, because of your mercy, God, I'm going to present my life a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto you. I don't care if $5 are involved. I'm in. And she was in to the death. That's what I love. And there's even a New Testament component to that concept that is, you know, if any man be my disciple, he must deny himself, take up his cross. That to the death mindset is something Jesus said was essential for any true follower. She beat us to the punch, guys. Before Jesus, she said, to the death, I'm in. It's really inspirational. Kind of no wonder that God includes this lady in his very genealogy, right? He's looking at this from heaven. And of course, in his sovereignty, he's orchestrating this, but he's like, oh yeah, she's in. She's my kind of gal. She's in. She's going to be part of the fam, actually. Pretty cool. look at verse 18. It says, when she, that's Naomi, of course, saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. Now, that's precious because Naomi can see the determination in this young lady's eyes. And she, I can't prove it, but I think a smile probably crossed across or flashed across her face. Like, man, you're serious. And she wanted company. You know, she didn't want to make the long journey back as a widow with no relationships. You know, there's a part of this that really ministered to Naomi, right? She loved this girl. And she's like, man, I can't turn this girl away. And so she's at that point, she's like, okay, come on, pack your bags. Precious. But at the same time, there's a principle here too, guys. Does the world see that determination in our eyes, in our speech? You know, when the world tries to discourage you from following Christ and going back into the world, do they see this blaze in your eyes? And do they hear in your speech, it's not an option? So they say, all right, that guy's obviously solid and, you know, not easily persuaded. Do you know what I'm saying? Can I give a personal example? This is a weird one. But I remember working, and I've probably shared it before. I hope it isn't. I'm starting to repeat myself. My sons are telling me that all the time. Dad, you told that story like a month ago, and you act like it's the first time. Well, here we go. I remember freshly being saved and working at a produce place. And I remember this dirty truck driver comes into the, you're already shaking your head. Yeah. Dirty truck driver, and he put in my face a pornographic picture. And man, I convinced him with my eyes and my speech, don't ever do that again. I love my wife. Do not flash that junk in my face. And the truth is, and I had to, you know, go and talk with the owner and go through all that stuff, but he never did it again. He never put that smut in my face again. He got the point. And that's one example. Do you have those stories? Or does the world see you as a play toy? They can flash at you. You're like just easily led away by your appetites. Are we easily led away back to Moab with just a little flash of an enticing picture or a smell or a song or a memory? I think we ought to have, like Ruth, such a grit and such a speech rehearsed that they're like, all right, I got nothing else to say. Never mind. I think there's something to that zeal personally. Rehearse a speech. Polish it up from time to time. Verse 19, let's move on to the end of this chapter. So they too went until they came to Bethlehem. And it came to pass that when they were come to Bethlehem, that all the city was moved about them. And they said, and there's a gasp to this. Again, studying the language, there's a gasp to this statement. Is this Naomi? It's almost like they couldn't believe their eyes. It's only been 10 years. Was she 40 when she left? Was she 30 when she left? Whatever she looked like when she came back, they're going, oh my goodness, that's Naomi. And it wasn't so much that 10 years had just aged her, it's the sorrow. It's the no sleep. I lost my husband and all the grief that she went through. And then both her sons. And this lady aged 30 years and 10, right? It's the sorrow and the grief and the anxiety of fretting that you're against me, God, you're against me. It's all of that had just put deep aged lines on her face, and she was hardly recognizable. And literally, if we're reading this in Hebrew, they're saying, is this pleasant? That's what her name meant. And just hearing that name, you know, did something to Naomi. Obviously, there was a story behind that. She was named that for a reason. Probably all her life, you know, her dad would put his hands on her little cheeks, say, here's my pleasant little girl, and that carried something with it. You know, probably a beautiful Jewish woman. But now everyone's like, whoa, what happened to pleasant? And sad, right? It's sad. And, you know, I've had that experience. You've had that experience. You know, step out of the world, man, and live for Jesus for 10 years and then go to a family reunion or a high school reunion or a wedding. And you see people and you rib your wife. And go, oh, my goodness, you know who that is over there? No, who is that? That's Sarah. You know, or whatever. That's Joey. And it sin, man, and guilt and the hardness of this life, man, it weathers an individual. And Naomi actually has a violent reaction to all of this, a volatile reaction. She says in verse 20, unto them, call me not pleasant, is the idea. Call me bitter, Mara. For the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. And this is a very, very interesting perspective. Don't miss this. I went out full, and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why would you call me pleasant, seeing the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me? It's a very, very interesting perspective from Naomi, and it's a hard lesson, but a good lesson learned. By the way, this isn't necessarily a bad thing. This is actually a very, very important revelation. Because listen, when Naomi and Elimelech, when they first left 10 years ago to go to Moab, they actually thought they were empty, right? They're like, man, we can't live like this. What are we going to feed our kids? I mean, we got nothing. This place is just a wasteland. they went against their conscience to do so, but they made the very responsible parental decision to leave God and leave the covenant and run to a paycheck. And they thought at that point they were empty. They thought they were running towards fullness. But do you see how time and God and his faithfulness and difficulty has flipped that whole thing over? And now Naomi realizes, man, I thought I was empty 10 years ago. The truth is I had everything back then. I had God. I had my husband. I had my sons. I had everything. Yeah, we were hungry, but I wouldn't trade this right now for anything in the world if I could have all of that back. All that what I thought was empty was everything to me, and now it's gone. And now I'm empty. Now I get empty. I thought I understood it then. Now I know it. Because guess what? Relationships are more important than stewardship. Relationships are way more important than all the monetary stuff. Put relationships first. Appreciate this, guys. The world can't take this away from us. The world can take our paychecks from us. They can. All they got to do is crank the gas prices up, and we are screwed. Right? Right? Although, we got wood. We got Dia. We got Biba. You know, well, we can survive, but you know exactly what I'm talking about. We can't put all our emphasis on the monetary stuff and neglect relationships to do so. This is the precious thing. And this is the precious thing, right? Our relationship with him. And boy, she gets that. She gets that. So, to come home empty in this sense, she's broken, man. She's desperate. We've seen a lot of people come into this ministry empty. And then to watch the Lord, you know, put the pieces back together and fill them up with his love and fill them up with his spirit even. Important. Oh, my goodness. What time is it? Are you kidding me? I felt like I had days left. I'm sorry. Well, I guess we'll finish this chapter. I was going to get to chapter 3 tonight. All right, I'll finish up. I know you're ready. So Naomi returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of barley harvest. So good times in Israel. Prosperity. Seems like God is favoring his people again. There's a righteousness that's happening. And can't wait to get into chapter 2, but we won't. Okay, that'll be next time. Okay, church, pray with me. That's all of the time we have. Father, thank you so much for your word this evening, and thank you for the principles and the truths that we talked about. I pray for my own life, Lord, that I would just cleave to you. Even when it surpasses understanding to do so, nothing makes sense. Help me to cleave to you, and I pray that my friends and my family in this room would do likewise. That we would just absolutely abide in you at all costs, Lord. And as we visit now and fellowship and pray for one another and do what we do best around here, just hang out. I just pray that your spirit would be very center in all of that and guide our conversations, Lord. And minister to our hearts. We ask this in Jesus' name, amen.